Peace of the Lord be with you. Sit down. Hey, tell somebody to your right what you did this summer. One thing you did this summer. Tell somebody to the right. Or to your left, professor. To your All right, let's gather back. Hey, it's so good to see you. I missed you. I'll come in here in the summertime and I'll just like talk to myself and people think I'm crazy because I'm just imagining you're all here. My summer was good. It was filled with a sense of anticipation and I would describe it as one of waiting. I'm gonna take you with me to early August. I can't remember the date. I do know it's 10 days past our due date. Kristen is inside cleaning out the pantry, a project she's been waiting in case the baby didn't come on time. The house is anxious. It's a little unnerving right now. Kristen's getting nervous, worried something might be going wrong with the baby. I'm outside in the garage lounge. Sipping a cold glass of water, trying to read, trying to journal just a little bit, watching my dog Woodby chase shadows on the driveway. His favorite activity, he'll dart left and he'll dart right and he'll go round and round his tail until finally he's tired and drops tail first into the shade. I wonder whether my dog knows that any minute now a baby's coming. I think he does. And I'm comforted by the thought that for the first few years of this child's life, it will have a trusty dog as a companion. I'm sitting in the garage lounge, journaling a little bit. There's things that I'm excited about. I'm excited that this baby will get to grow up into a real community of faith, a real community of family, and a real community of friends. A lot of people have an idea of a community as a wishful thought, but we actually have one as a reality. And I'm excited for this little baby to enter into this and have that community help raise it and speak to it. I'm excited that this child, I get to be a first-hand explorer with the baby as it enters into this world, its sense of discovery. It's all of these wonderful things it gets to learn about. It gets to learn about Bach, and it gets to learn about Wallace Stegner, and it gets to go to the grocery store for the first time and get Pringles and pop it open and try it out on the curve of the tongue and feel what pleasurable, what pure genius it was, the man who created the Pringle. I'm excited for him to know those things. I'm excited to know who this little one will be. It will have its own personality. I mean, for sure, my DNA and Kristen's DNA will all get mixed in there, but it'll be its own person, its own life, and it will have its own story that I'll just get to be a footnote in, a part of, but it's going to have his own interests and passions, and I'm eager to find out what those are, what his temperament will be. I'm excited most, as I write in the journal, to hear the baby laugh. I don't know if there's anything more pure than a child laughing. It's utterly exposed and vulnerable, and the best word to describe it would be innocence. And I'm excited to experience that again, that sense of playful innocence, of total trust. I'm excited, but even as I write, that excitement starts to make me a little anxious. So I get up out of the garage lounge and I go into the backyard, a narrow strip of property at 79 West 13th Street, and I start pacing back and forth, about 29 steps back, 29 steps forward. I keep walking past the white picnic table and the park bench that I've unsuccessfully tried to restore and repaint three different times. I walk past the little stone that I've created into a pitcher's mound for competitive wiffle ball games with my backyard neighbor, John Van Dynen. I go back and forth until I get tired, and I plop myself down in an Adirondack chair that I recently bought, and I sit right in front of it. It's right there. It's sitting there with wood in it, and it's waiting, just like Kristen inside the house. Our nesting started months ago, right after the school year ended, and all of you packed up your bags and got into your cars and went north, south, east, and west. Kristen and I started a real intense nesting process. It started with paint. We painted the patio, and then we painted the walls. Well, we painted. I actually hired Jerry Root to do it for me because, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. We painted the guest room, and then we painted the baby's room, I think Hawthorne yellow. The baby's room used to be my study, but now I'm back in the garage lounge with the dog, reading books and typing on my journal. But that's all right. Started with paint, but it then moved into deep cleaning the carpets. It then moved into rearranging all of the books on the shelves. It then went down into the basement where we cleaned out the basement twice. And then I've already told you about the pantry. But it'd be misleading for me to say that all of our nesting was just domestic. It creeped into the outside. We mulched flower beds, and I'm not a man who mulches. We edged the sidewalks, planted flowers and trees. But the mark of my primal nesting instinct happened one June Saturday when I got up early, went to the garage lounge, pulled out a shovel, which is about the only tool that I own, and I marched into the backyard and I started digging a round hole. Till I got a round circumference in a hole. I better do something with this. Went back inside, got on the internet, found a website for this old house, and I got instructions to build a proper fire pit. Said I needed some tools, said I needed some ingredients. So there I was, got into the silver Subaru and headed down to Menards. Now, I'm not a man that goes to Menards, and this is kind of a big deal trip for me. Me going to Menards is like the Detroit Lions making the Super Bowl. It just doesn't happen very often. But I found a guy there. He had a green little thingy on, and I said, "Man in the green thingy, I'm building a proper fire pit. Can you help me?" "Oh, yeah, come on over." So we looked at different stone, different shape, different size. I said, "What kind? You want it square? You want a rectangle, an octagon?" No, dude, it's a circle. I cut a circle. So, we'll get some stone that can fit a circle. So we got some stone. I got some pea gravel to fit into it. I got an iron cylinder to put inside of it. I went home with all of my ingredients. I spent Saturday and all day Sunday building myself a proper fire. I gotta tell you, it's nice. It's even level. And I've got a tool to prove it. There I am, sitting in front of the fire pit. It's waiting. Now, why did I build a fire pit, that primal instinct in me? Because something I think happens at a fire pit that doesn't happen in other places. You know what I'm saying? There's something about having a big sky open and the stars twinkling at you and giving just a little bit of light and having that light flicker on the faces. Around the fire pit is where you tell the stories that matter. It's where you tell the family stories. It's where you tell the folk Norwegian legends. But mostly it's the place where you tell the stories that help you believe in an enchanted world. And that's what I want this little one to live with, to grow up with a sense that this world is enchanted. And what I mean by this is that this is a world that God speaks into. There's a big dog sociologist named, I'm forgetting his name, Taylor, something Taylor. Charles Taylor, thank you very much. That's right, Josh, coming through for me. This is the problem when you preach without notes. You know, your head doesn't work. Charles Taylor wrote this book called The Secular Age, and he talks about we are now in a culture that is unprecedented in history where really there is nothing larger that we have to believe in. Faith in God is just one alternative among many, and he traces a large cultural movement all the way from the 1500s all the way to year 2000. And one of the marks that he says that has helped create what he calls the secular age is a sense of the loss of enchantment, that we no longer live in a world where God can speak. We no longer believe that there's angels or demons, that all that there is what we can see, feel, taste, and touch. The world isn't enchanted at all. In the secular age, it's just there for us to use and exploit. And instead of growing up in a world that is enchanted and full of wonders, with charged with the grandeur of God, my little one and you are growing up in a world with what Taylor describes as a self-sufficient humanism. And he defines self-sufficient humanism as a humanism that has no higher end or any allegiance to anything beyond one's own personal flourishing. There's no higher goal. There's no higher loyalty than to one's own personal human flourishing. That's the cultural condition that we're in. Because I think we've lost our fire pits. We've lost the places that we can gather and to whisper that there might be something larger that we're all part of, something larger that calls each one of us, draws us into a world that is more significant than just our own personal flourishing. We need a place to go where we hear the stories that throw light and warmth into our lives long after the embers have grown cold. We need a place to learn about God. And I have this image of sitting in the Adirondack chair with my little one and the fire flickering under the open sky, telling the stories about the saga of God. And I want to tell one of those stories tonight. It's a story that you are involved in, but you're not the central character. The central character belongs to God. And it is the story that opens up the book that we love. It is the creation story, chapter 1. Imagine that we're sitting around the campfire. Close your eyes if you need to, and imagine yourself outside in one of those clear, beautiful autumn days. Listen to this. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered over the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. And then God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. God separated the light from the darkness. The light he called day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And then God said, "Let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." And it was so. God made the dome and separated the waters that were under the dome from the waters that were above the dome. And God called the dome sky. And there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And then God said, "Let the waters under the dome be gathered into one place, and let dry land appear." And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered into one place he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees of every kind on the earth that bear fruit with the seed in it." And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees of every kind that bear fruit with the seed still in it. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And then God said, "Let the earth bring..." Then God said, "Let there be lights in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years, and let there be light in order to separate the day from the night." And it was so. God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. God set them in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. And then God said, "Let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let winged birds fly above the earth, across the dome of the sky." So God created the great sea monsters, and every living creature of every kind with which the waters swarm, and every winged bird of every kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth." And there was evening, and there was morning, the fifth day. And then God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures, cattle and creeping things, and wild animals of the earth of every kind." And it was so. God made the wild animals of the earth of every kind, and the cattle of every kind, and everything that creeps upon the ground of every kind. And God saw that it was good. And then God said, Let us create humankind in our image, according to our likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over all the cattle and over all the wild animals of the earth and over everything that creeps upon the earth. So God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. And have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over everything that moves upon the earth. And God said, see, I've given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of the earth, and every tree that bears seed within its fruit. You shall have these for food. And to every beast of the field, to every bird of the air, to everything that creeps upon the earth, to everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made. Indeed, it was very good. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished in all of their multitude. And on the seventh day, God finished all the work that he had done. And God rested on the seventh day from all the work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it. For on the seventh day, God rested from all the work that he had done in creation. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. This is the story that I want to tell around the fire pit. This is the story that throws light and warmth into our soul long after the embers have grown cold. The creation story of Genesis is and is not many things, but one of the things that it is a story about God. It is about God's sovereignty. It is about a God who has the transcendent power to cast the galaxies into place while still possessing the tenderness to breathe into us the breath of life. The book of Genesis and the creation story is and is not many things, but one of the things that it is an invitation to re-see the world with enchantment, a world that has rhythm, a world where chaos gives way to order, a world where light is separated from darkness, a world that is intrinsically affirmed as good, a world that is created by the imagination of a cosmic artist whose breath gives us breath and whose skilled hands throw the sun and the moon and cast broadside the stars and the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth. It is a story that invites us to see that the climax of creativity is rest. And all of it happens with the fundamental activity of what God does. You see, I want the little one to absorb a fundamental truth about God. Because the more we learn about who God is, the more we learn about who we are. If you heard, we are made in God's image. So what we learn about the nature and character and activity of God should shape our nature, character, and activity. And the first thing that we know about who God is and what God does is this. God speaks. God's speech creates reality. This is the first thing that we know about God. God is a God who speaks. God communicates. God is loquacious. God is oral. The fundamental primary activity of God is to speak to us. And whenever God speaks, something new is created. This is the first thing that we know about God. 13 times in chapter 1 alone, God says. God says, and it is so, and it is good. God says, let there be light, and there was light. Let there be sky. Let there be trees and plants. Let there be sun and moon and stars. Let there be giant sea monsters and winged birds. And let there be cattle and creeping things and wild animals. And then, let there be women, and let there be men, and let them be made in our image. God blesses them. Have dominion. God is speaking. And in God's speech creates reality. This is the fundamental activity of God. Everything that we see, everywhere that we go, is a product of the divine imagination of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The first thing that we know about God is that God speaks. And the more we learn about what God does, the more we learn about what we are to do. Now, you know, I like my words. I like big words and I like small words. I like fat words and I like skinny words. I like old words and I like new words. I like words and I like listening to those who know how to use them. I like listening to poets and I like reading great novelists. I love to hear the singer and the songwriter put beautiful poetry to music. I like language because it does something. It has that rare capacity to pull open the soul and make us feel and ache the way nothing else can. I think our words are important. Yet we live in a culture, in a moment, that thinks our language doesn't matter, that we can reduce our communication to just texting. It just gets to be information rather than having our language and our words and our speech be something that forms in us something large. See, I think that our word sickness of our culture is a spiritual issue. When our words are reduced, so are our lives. When we lose the meaning of our speech, sooner or later, so do our lives. When our language becomes dull and insipid and lazy and boring, so do our lives. And I believe that here at Hope College, we are invited to use language differently. To use language in such a way that it opens up the possibility of another kind of conversation. A conversation that, if heard with freedom, pushes us out of the presumed world in which most of us are trapped and desperately longing to get out of, and to be reformed into something beautiful. What if every day, on the way to class, in the dorm, the athletic field, in chapel, wherever you are, wherever you go, we made a conscious decision to use our language in a way that created beauty? God speaks, and it is good, or a more proper translation, it is beautiful. God's word creates reality. It does something within us. Eugene Peterson says that it is the very nature of language to form rather than inform. When language is personal, which it is at its best, it reveals, and revelation is always personal. We don't know more, we become more. Our best users of language, our lovers and poets and children and saints, use words to make intimacy, make character, make beauty, make goodness, make truth, which is exactly, if you notice, what we observe God doing in chapter 1. God uses speech to make something, to remake us. And the good news, my friends, is that God still does. This speaking God is still speaking. There is still the possibility and opportunity every day to hear a new word from God. And when God speaks, something new can be created. Which means that you don't have to be who you were before. It means that whatever circumstance you're in can be changed by the power of the word. But it does mean that we have to be in a posture to listen. Good speaking is one side of the coin. Good listening is the other. And I'm here to propose to you the possibility that this is an enchanted world, a world where God is still speaking to you through the scriptures, still speaking through the church, still speaking through preaching, and still speaking fundamentally through the living word, whose name is above every name, who is above every dominion and power and principality. There is one who is still speaking, who is seated on the throne, and his head and his hair is as white as white wool. His eyes are like a flame of fire. His feet are like burnished bronze. And his voice is like the sound of many waters. And from his mouth comes a sharp, two-edged sword. And his name is Jesus. This Jesus is the eternal one that was at day one of creation, the light that shines in the darkness. This Jesus is the one who is still speaking and whose word still has the power to recreate us. Which is my prayer for us as we begin this gathering season, as we step into this saga of God, of Genesis, is that we would be in a posture to listen to a God who speaks. Would you pray with me? God, we can't make you speak, and so we need you in your freedom to speak to us through your scriptures, speak to us through your church, speak to us through your word in all things. Recreate us by the power of your word, that we might know you and love you and walk in a world filled with the enchantment of your voice that is always calling us and making us your own. And we pray this in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And everyone said,